This is Matthew Putman, and you're listening to Utility Function. I had a wonderful time getting to sit down with Dr. Kate Darling, who is a robot ethicist. This is certainly a new field and an important one as we start to share the world and our lives with things other than animals and ourselves. The way that people interact with robots is something that not only affects our jobs and the future, but how we take comfort, how we deal with privacy, how we deal with humanity in general, not just with robots. You're going to love this conversation. She has a passion for technology and robots and many interdisciplinary fields that we touch on. After co-teaching a robot ethics course at Harvard Law School with Professor Lawrence Lessig, she began to work at the intersection of law and robotics with a focus on legal and social issues. She's a former fellow at the Harvard Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society and the Yale Information Society Project. She's also an affiliate at the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. You can check out her work many other places, including Vogue, The New Yorker, The Guardian, BBC, NPR, PBS, The Boston Globe, Forbes, CBC, Wired, The Atlantic, and many others. I hope we get into some new territory here, but it was a great pleasure to be able to discuss Dr. Kate Darling's life and her ongoing work. Thank you and enjoy. Thanks so much again, Kate, for coming on at a distance. I'm really anxiously awaiting your new book, and everybody I've spoken to about doing this interview is interested in it. Do you mind just diving in and speaking about it a bit?
Sure. Yeah, I'm pretty excited about it. I wrote most of it during the pandemic year, so I haven't been doing much else. The book is called The New Breed: What Our History with Animals Teaches Us About Our Future with Robots. And it looks at how we've domesticated animals and used them for work, for weaponry, for companionship, and tries to reframe some of the conversations that we've been having around robots and artificial intelligence. Because the thing that has always struck me about all of the conversations that I have with people, whether they're in robotics, whether they're, you know, at a garden party, like anyone I talk to about robots, we're often subconsciously comparing robots to humans and artificial intelligence to human intelligence. And I've always found that that analogy doesn't quite work for me. First of all, technically, it doesn't make a lot of sense since artificial intelligence is very different from human intelligence. But then also, we do have this history of dealing with kind of these autonomous thinking agents that are not human. And animals have kind of been a partner in what we're trying to achieve rather than something that replaces humans or is like humans. And so I really think that pushing this analogy helps change some of the conversations around work, around companionship, around even ethics, in ways that we just haven't been thinking about.
Yeah, I'm interested in this too. I mean, I interviewed Peter Singer on this podcast.
Which Peter Singer?
Peter Singer, the Princeton philosopher.
Oh, wow. Cool.
Yeah. Well, it was really a great opportunity. I mean, he was very influential for me at a distance. And so it was great to talk to him. And of course, his work on animal rights for all of these years. Has this historically been something that, you know, I think of the animal rights movement as maybe not starting with Peter, but being a modern idea. But domestication is not so modern. Does our relating to and empathizing with animals go back a long time?
It does go back a long time. But the rights movement itself is very complicated in that regard, because it used to be in Western society that people, you know, once people started having pets in the Victorian era, they became very emotionally attached to the animals that they had a social relationship with. But people were still kind of like, oh, but laws protecting them would go much too far. That would be, you know, what floodgates would that open? That would be such a slippery slope. And it wasn't until, you know, there some of the animal rights activists started using different arguments that weren't really about our emotional connection to animals, but were about, you know, what is it? Does it make for cruel humans to treat animals unkindly? And that really kind of started the whole rights movement back in the 1800s, and then. There was kind of a shift with Peter Singer and some of the more modern animal rights philosophers, where now we're talking about rights for the animals themselves, for the sake of the animals themselves. But it took a little bit of finagling in the beginning to get people on board with the idea of giving rights to animals, even though people were emotionally attached to them.
Yeah, I mean, we'll get into artificial intelligence, which is obviously, and robotics, which is obviously the important part of much of your life and work and contribution. But I was watching old episodes of Little House on the Prairie. Do you remember that show?
Oh my gosh. Well, I read the books as a kid.
Yeah, the books, we have them at home. My wife is reading some of them. I stepped in. In the middle of an episode last night, and it was somebody, one of the characters telling his young kid that, you know, we love our animals, our dogs and our cats and so on, or dogs, I guess, in that show. But we don't name our other animals, right? Our animals that we use for work and for food. I wonder if this is, We are now talking philosophically about how we relate to animals, but also then how we relate to robots, that it's kind of easy to say at a distance that we won't feel for something. But when you're very close to it, you start to have this different response. Do you find that you have to actually do demonstrations of either being around an animal or being around a robot that has some type of, you know, personal connection to a person to get this point across?
Well, I mean, there's a ton of research that shows, you know, exactly what you said, that we have this tendency to treat animals very differently depending on whether we have a emotional or a cultural connection to the animal. And there are some animals we treat like tools and products, and some we treat like our companions. And we're starting to see the same thing happen with robots, where people don't actually care so much about the inherent capabilities of the robot or whether it's smart. They just care about whether they've interacted with it and whether it's cute. And they tend to develop emotional connections, the ones that they, you know, find emotionally attractive. And if you look at the history of kind of the big pushes for animal rights, they did seem to be largely driven by emotional and cultural connections. I mean, even today, right? Like, well, we love our dogs. You're not allowed to eat dog or cat meat in the United States, but, you know, there's Burger Kings on every corner where you can get a burger. So
it seems like a hypocrisy, doesn't it, in a way?
Well, I mean, it's a hypocrisy according to, you know, the Peter Singer School of Animal Rights, which I think most of us want to believe that that's what we care about. We care about whether animals feel pain, whether they suffer, but it doesn't really bear out in the data that that's truly what we care about. And I think what's so interesting about the human-robot interaction research is that it really shows that, right? Because now we're dealing with something that doesn't feel pain, does not have any kind of consciousness, and people are already developing emotional connections and like feeling weird about certain robots being mistreated, even though we mistreat certain animals all the time.
Yeah, you say in, I think it was a 2018 TED Talk you gave, you said that your family's named their Roomba and get it attached. I had that same thing happen to
at home that when my son was younger, we had one break and we actually had to keep it because it was named and we had to keep it for a while in order to not break the tie even after it stopped working.
What was its name?
Barbichette.
Oh.
Actually, that one. So I have my wife and kids are French, and it was actually that one was Moustache, and the new one is Barbichette.
That's so funny.
Yeah, has much more abilities than the old one. So, but the emotional connection was kind of the same, which is also interesting. It doesn't. I don't know. I wonder how much it matters how sophisticated the robot is.
I mean, it matters. It can matter. It can factor in, but it doesn't actually matter that much. Like I just got a Paro experiments with. Yeah, you've heard of the baby seal robot. It's used with dementia patients, and it doesn't do much. Like it just kind of responds to your touch and makes these really cute sounds and looks like a baby harp seal. And that one is so emotionally compelling. It can't vacuum my floor, but you know, people respond to it as though it's a pet. So the actual like technical capabilities of the robot don't necessarily have to matter as much.
Yeah, I'm wondering if. How much difference if we were to separate the difference between an animal, and I don't know if we think about home domesticated animals versus these other work animals or animals at a distance or something that we're talking about, but a robot is human program, or even if it's a very sophisticated AI, which most aren't, let's say something that has reinforcement learning or something that learns similar to how we think cortical human behavior is. This is inherently different than an animal. An animal has, we don't know what its consciousness is. We're not even sure what human consciousness is, but we don't know particularly. It is a definitely different breed where robots are a creation of humans. Does that make any difference?
Oh yeah, absolutely. And I should say like the book goes through a lot of parallels between robots and animals, but the whole point of the book is not to say that they're equivalent, right? You cannot dictate an email to an animal. A lot of animals have skills that robots will never have. And like you said, you know, there are some parallels in that we've bred animals and trained them to do certain things, but you know, the intelligence aspect is different. It is a new breed, and hence the title of the book. It's not, here's a new animal. it's a new category. But I do think that the thought exercise helps us, because right now we're so fixated on comparing robots to people. When we talk about robots taking jobs, when we talk about artificial intelligence, we're comparing to human intelligence. And so I think it's really important that we look at a different example, and the animal world actually has like this huge diversity of different skills and intelligences. And I think that's a much better analogy for, you know, how to think a little bit outside of the box when we're designing and integrating robots. We don't necessarily need to build something that is like us. We can build something completely new.
Do you think that it's a positive to build something that we do have compassion for?
That is a really difficult question, because it depends on why we do that. Right. I think that there are some really great use cases, and I'm not concerned about it inherently. Like, I don't think that it's bad for us to develop emotional connections to machines. I think that we are capable of all sorts of different relationships. You know, if you look at, again, animals and how we've incorporated pets into our lives as a relationship that doesn't take away from our human relationships, but is just like kind of a different thing that we relate to and have. I think that there are some really cool things that we could do with social robots and connections to machines. There's already some really cool therapy methods. There's some research on health and education, working with children who have autism, working the Paro seal, which is an animal therapy replacement. I think all of these things could be really positive. My concern is, of course, that, you know, we live in a very capitalist society where I also envision companies perhaps using emotional connections to machines to try to manipulate people, not for their own benefit in health and education, but for the company's benefit. So if you think about, you know, how robots might be able to advertise to people, maybe your sex robot has compelling in-app purchases that kind of take advantage. It's kind of like, the advertising we've had previously, but on steroids, because if you can really harness the social emotional connection, that's pretty powerful. So yeah, I think it really depends on how we're using it. I don't think it's inherently bad or good.
I'm worried about the same thing. It's even, while I don't think that Roomba is in my house collecting data and listening to me, I know that my Amazon Echo is, there's certainly an attachment to that, and and it doesn't move, it doesn't look like anything, but we ask Alexa for everything, and it's definitely something that's being used to market to us. And so there's a sense of being spied on all the time, as soon as you start getting more really comfortable, and that sense will start to go away. And I do notice that we're more and more comfortable with saying whatever we want, and it's only when you think about it afterwards, what if everything in our life that we get attached to is that way?
Oh, totally. And like we've totally traded with the Alexa. It's not even, I don't find Alexa very compelling socially, but the functionality is so important to me that I will trade my privacy, which is a terrible thing. But that's what we're seeing happen, because people understand the direct benefit that they get from these products. And then the harms are kind of more invisible and like on a societal level. So it's harder to weigh that. And as these technologies get more social, I can just imagine that getting even more complex, because, Alexa right now, like, is not great at marketing to me, but if Alexa and I really had a relationship and like would shoot the shit after work every day, and she started suggesting things, I mean, it would have to be a little subtle, because, I'd be on to her pretty quickly, but I don't know, would my kids be on to her? Like, I think this is a new kind of consumer manipulation that we need to be very careful with.
That's an incredibly important role you're playing, I think, because, if what do we sacrifice, and are we focused on that right thing that we're sacrificing? It's very quick that we give that up. It's amazing to me, by the way, that everything in our world seems like the biggest business in the world is ads, right? So you have these big companies. It's like, I think about, Google, Facebook, any of these companies are based around advertising to us. It's feasible that that could change. And people buy robots like they buy animals as a business itself, because they want them around. There's not a marketing component. You see that as a possibility?
I think it's possible. I don't know if it's likely, unless we have strong consumer protection laws and the right incentives to guide companies. I do think that right now, I don't think we fully understand the use case for robots just as social companions. Like, there have been some robots that have gone into people's households that are, something beyond Alexa. They're more social. Like Jibo was a company that started up and then didn't make it. There are a couple others that started up and like almost made it and didn't. And I think that those are kind of the Palm Pilots because of this world, because what you see is that the people who did buy them became very emotionally attached and totally saw the utility of having this kind of companion in their home. And I think that just the broader market hasn't realized that that's actually valuable yet.
Well, one place where we don't see the ad business so much, but we see productivity or something where you spend a lot of time, is at work. And I know you address this in the you likely address this if you look at the description of your book. But if I think about, the factory robots, even my company, we make automation and robots, nothing that has any personality yet. But, if we really stress the interaction between, machines and humans as being this new hybrid reality that we live in as a positive thing, you have these you know, aides to doing, you know, labor that is just, you know, difficult for humans and, you know, hurts humans. But eventually, if there's enough of this, we're going to be interacting with these robots in a way that, if it's designed in certain ways, will make us feel. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah. So the whole first part of the book looks at automation in the labor market and how we're thinking about it and how we might want to shift our thinking, given the fact that, like you say, you know, robots often take jobs that humans are less good at. And that's because our skill sets are very different. Like, robots are good at some things that we're not good at. We're really good at some things that robots aren't good at. And that's partly why we haven't even been able to fully automate car manufacturing, which you would think, you know, we've had robots for like five decades in those contexts, but we still haven't been able to fully automate because what's really most effective is having a team of robots and humans, and having robots and humans interact and having their skills be complementary to each other, kind of like how we've used animals in the past. So I think that's a really important shift to be thinking about, like, how can we create a future of human-robot interaction in the workplace? Because I think that's really where the potential is. And then on the, you know, social emotional side, there are a lot of design tricks that people are playing around with, but I think we also haven't quite realized how to harness this yet, around how you design robots so that people either treat them like tools or treat them like companions, depending on, you know, what you need in that context. And then, you know, whether they trust the robot too much. There's so much interesting psychology research around how we interact with these machines, because they're different than the devices we've worked with previously. They can think and they can make autonomous decisions and they can learn and they move in this autonomous way. So we respond to them as though they're agents. And I think it's really important to have that human-robot interaction mindset when you're integrating a robot into the workplace, because people treat them totally differently than other devices.
Yeah. Do you find that this is kind of an, even though, by the way, the automotive industry is slow to move with things, so I'm not quite sure if it's actually the technology or the industry. that's sort of a side note. But I wonder if it's also technological. I may be wrong in this observation, but it seems that robotics and artificial intelligence have not actually worked incredibly closely together in the past. I mean, I think about Japan, for instance, as being a very robot-centric place. Like, a lot of the design has happened in robotics in Japan, whereas a lot of artificial intelligence research has been done in the United States. Is this a time where these things are coming together, or am I just wrong? I mean, am I just have these two been tied for longer than I know?
Oh, no, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, and this is me coming from academia, which is a little bit different, but like, those two disciplines have been totally siloed. Right. Artificial intelligence and robotics are two totally different disciplines. They've had totally different conferences. Like, and so, of course, you know, with the academics going into industry, I think you're right that now we're starting to see them come together more, and, you know, we will start to see them come together more, which is good. I personally have just, like, as a side note, always been way more interested in robotics, because there's so much research showing how we treat robots differently than something that's on a screen or just a random algorithm. So my passion has always been physical robots, but I mean, what needs to happen right now in the world is really those things have to come together.
I see why you would say that, why it is so interesting. I mean, if things on a screen are different, at least for me, I shouldn't make that kind of generalization. People seem to be very tied to being able to do things virtually now that they have attachment to. Whereas I guess I'm getting old school and wanting to be around people, especially now. But you know, I remember when this first occurred to me is I played online chess, you know, and so I play online chess. You can play against an AI, or you could play against a person that you never chat with, never talk to, but you know that it's another person. And I almost always want to do that. I hardly ever want to play with the robot, even though it makes no difference at all. You know, the AI is a good player, will definitely be able to beat me. Whatever it might be, it'll be just as engaging of a game, but I just like to know that there's a human on the other end.
That's funny. I wonder also if that's a personality thing, though, because like maybe someone with social anxiety would prefer to play the computer. Like, I think it's good that we have options, right?
There's nothing wrong. It's not a value judgment. It is just a personal observation.
Totally. No, but like there is, I think it's not just, you know, you and me being old and crotchety about like physicality. I think that the physical world, there are some biological reasons that we gravitate towards physical communication over virtual. We're just very physical creatures, and we're evolutionarily kind of hardwired to communicate with much more than just with more than is available to us over screens. And that you see that very clearly in how people respond to robots versus virtual characters. Like, we respond to virtual characters. We will treat them like social actors. We will, you know, play chess against them or whatever it is. But when you have a physical robot in someone's space, that's a very visceral kind of communication where if it moves in a way that seems autonomous to you, you will automatically project life onto it. And that's, I think that's what's always just fascinated me so much about robots versus AI.
How far back does it go for you? Were you interested in this as a kid?
I mean, yeah, as a kid. Well, I read tons of sci-fi as a kid.
Yeah, I was wondering.
So did I.
Yeah, my dad had like all the like 60s, 70s like novels, all those paperbacks, and tore through them. But I guess I didn't think I could work in robotics. So I went to law school and then somehow magically found my way back to you know, what I've always been really interested in. I got lucky.
But did you actually practice patent law or just study?
I didn't practice. I did it. My PhD was in intellectual property and law and economics. So I did some, you know, scholarship and research, but no, I never became a lawyer.
Well, that's good. We would have lost you to that group of, this call would be costing me a couple $1,000 to do
this. They make a lot more money than I do.
There's definitely no small talk like this. We wouldn't have gone into my family Barbie chef robot Roomba. Let's talk. Do you mind talking about IP a little bit?
Oh, sure.
I mean, my question may be boring. I spend a lot of my time actually working on creating IP, and working on patents. And it was only when I started reading, your work and your thoughts and some articles you have, that I started to think of implications that go beyond the protection of the thing that I have already invented. So this may be a confusing question, but, you know, in general now, you can write a patent about something that you know is possible to be built. You have all of the physics are behind it, all the math is behind it, you're able to do it. And before even the final product is done, before you can see, and especially even if you've made it, before the final implication, especially if it's something that involves any learning algorithms. Do we have to start thinking about patents differently in order to think of long-term consequences?
Wow, that's a big question.
It probably didn't make any sense.
It totally does. Like, and I have to say, like, there are parallels between my current interest and why I got into IP law, because I've always been really interested in how systems shape human behavior. And the whole point of the patent system is supposed to be to incentivize innovation, right? You're supposed to be rewarded with this monopoly for, you know, creating ideas or inventions that are useful to society. And I think the problem that I've always had with our current patent system isn't that premise. It's that I don't think the system works very efficiently. You see how, like, in the pharmaceutical space, it makes a lot of sense that in order for companies to develop new drugs, they really need to be promised some sort of reward at the end of that process. Otherwise, they just, you know, sink $5 billion in, like, expensive clinical trials, and they would have no reason to do that if they didn't get something out of it in the end, and anyone could just copy and sell the generic right away. But then you look at areas like computer software, where, you know, your product is obsolete after probably 5 years, or it's different. And then you're like, okay, should we apply the patent system to this? And then you add to that the patent offices themselves are totally overwhelmed, and they can't even determine whether something is a new invention or not. So they end up issuing a bunch of bad patents that clog up the system. And so I think that's always been my main...
Are you speaking about my patents? Is that what you meant in that?
No, Matthew, I'm sure your patents are like... Yes, no,
those are the ones that are, you know, elevated.
Those are the real patents. Yeah, but and then there's also the fact that, like, it would be nice if some, you know, small inventor in a garage could, you know, get a patent on something, but we seem to have spun this into a system where, you know, getting a patent costs... I mean, how much do you spend on getting a patent on average? Do you know?
Yeah, I'd say $30,000.
Right. So I don't have $30,000 in my garage to, like, patent, you know.
Right.
And so then you need, you know, VC investment, and then it just, like, becomes this very complicated thing that doesn't quite match the, like, original, I guess, romanticized idea of, let's protect inventors for their cool ideas. So I think it's broken.
I didn't ask my question right. So we could even get away from patents in this, but I think patents could apply if you think of 20-year monopolies and corporations, as we, you know, we did mention earlier. What if you have this ability to use, you know, e-commerce for absolutely everything you do and everything that is around you, even things that you're socially, you know, connected to or personally connected to. It's, you could have a patent that is broad enough that right now it seems completely and unable, you know, robots could seem at their very infancy of being personal to you, but the patent could protect it, or that, you know, a company could just create something that, you know, they get a monopoly on. That, you know, I don't know if people are looking with lenses beyond 5 years and looking to the full 20-year life cycle.
And by people, you mean the people, the inventors?
When I say inventors, I mean, you know, let's see, you know, it's or patent office. I'm wondering who, I guess it's kind of a sci-fi thought, but who right now is becoming, you know, iRobot, right? What company is becoming, and I don't mean Roomba's iRobot, but I mean...
There's literally a company called iRobot.
I know, that's why I got here. But no, Alec Asimov, right? Is there you could be creating a company that's producing monopoly, a legal monopoly, that in 5 years, the technology will be available for it to be extremely powerful.
Yeah, well, there is... I wonder if patents are really going to be that power, because
maybe not. Yeah,
I mean, what I see right now, and this can change depending on what direction AI development goes in, but right now a lot of the more powerful AI applications use a lot of data, and so the companies that have the most data are really the ones who have all the power and have the, you know, the monopoly or oligopoly. You know, there's five companies in the world who have the most data, and so that's not necessarily something that's protected by IP, but they control it. So it could be data, it could be IP. There's, it kind of depends. But I think right now I'm most worried about data being just such a source of power, and something that's not limited to 20 years. You know, they don't have to ever, I don't know how anyone would amass the data that Google has today by just entering the market. So I think that would be my concern.
Yeah, I agree. I definitely worry about the same thing. You know, what could be interesting about this is, you know, if I think about having a, back to the animals, if you have an animal, you know, there are genetics built in there. There's programming, of course, there's all of the life that is built into any organism. And the same thing would be true with a robot that has some type of programming. But if it's a learning machine, it becomes yours. And, you know, it becomes something that reacts especially unique, you know, uniquely to you. So in a sense, that becomes a program, an invention of your own that is also a companion, which is a fascinating idea. I mean, we have this in things like imitation learning, but it's not very super advanced yet. But I find that an interesting direction.
Yeah, that is interesting. I do think there are parallels to like how we've bred and trained animals. And like I see parallels to my, you know, 3-year-old too, although again, I'm trying to steer away from the human analogy here. But yeah, when you can train something and it's personalized to you, that is a very different type of relationship than, you know, just having a generic toaster.
Yes, yes. I mean, and you can't take the human error and out of it. I mean, this is all about human interaction. So, you know, thinking of a 3-year-old isn't that bad. this is what we're all going to be doing. And as I said, you know, I'm in here in Florida right now. My parents have my mother's with this dog all the time. And it's very, very personal. And it's very humanly personal. It's, you know, we were driving from the airport and we were talking about what was this dog feeling going into surgery? What was she thinking? You know, and try to think of that. We assume it's similar to human thoughts, although it isn't completely. Are we going to be able to do any auditing and understand what a robot has done to make its decisions? Will we ever know what is really going on underneath the skin, so to speak?
Yeah, that's such a great question because, like you say, like we make a lot of assumptions about animals. We have this tendency to anthropomorphize anything, project our own emotions and traits and behaviors onto anything. But we really love to do this with animals. And like you said, like we're constantly like guessing, oh, the dog feels this, the dog's doing this because of that. And it's funny that like animal science has gone through these different phases where there was a phase where people were like, we can't do this. We have to be very rational and not project any human emotions onto the animals when we're studying them, which makes sense, except it's impossible not to do that. And there's a newer branch of animal science that's now arguing that because it's impossible, you actually make mistakes when you try to be rational too. And that, in fact, we should probably embrace some of this anthropomorphism, but be very aware of it and try to use it to learn rather than try to banish it entirely. And it's so interesting to me that we do the same thing with robots. We anthropomorphize them and we project human traits onto them. And so I think you're right that it's sometimes hard to keep people focused on the actual capabilities or the actual intelligence of the thing, because they make a lot of assumptions about what it can or can't do or what it's feeling. And they don't care if the assumptions are wrong. Like how we don't care, like we know that our assumptions about animals are silly sometimes, but we enjoy making those assumptions anyway. And so people are going to do that with robots too. And so I think we're going to have to walk the same line of embracing that to some extent and trying to learn from it.
Yeah, learning about ourselves, but also learning what our creations are. You know, why we do what we do, but at the same time, how are we building those things? This is going to shift us. We're going to be different.
Right.
That's really interesting. I mean, and when you said that, I hadn't thought about this sort of lab animal thought. You know, I mean, robots are very much, you work in academia, you work in labs, you build things that you construct and deconstruct. And, you know, have you ever worked in a neuroscience lab before?
No, I haven't.
It's kind of I one time worked at a lab at Columbia I didn't really work in there, but I had a microscope that I had made that was in this lab, and it was, you know, they were doing experiments on rats. And I mean, I'm really sensitive to stuff like this. It's liable to bring me to tears to think about, you know, this sort of lab research. But after a few days of this, you know, you take a rat, run them through things, and then you dissect the rat and you slice the brain and look at the brain and figure out what was going on in the cortex. And it's a strange thing. And, you know, trying to distance yourself from it, but at the same time, realizing that this is a life form and trying to figure out how humans behave because of it, which is the point of the research. It was actually something that came to mind when I saw, these things that you showed on your TED talk and other places where, you know, kill the robot, essentially. This desire then to, what if you not just take apart the pieces of something that either you made or somebody else made, but start to look into the brain, start to look at the programming and figure it out and see how that is similar to you or different, what that does to go the one extra layer.
I love this question. Yeah. So because we are able to compartmentalize and to desensitize ourselves in certain contexts and rationalize. And, you know, like a doctor who, you know, has to, or a surgeon who has to slice through human skin, like it's different. If the surgeon were slicing through human skin in a different context, it might like land differently emotionally, but we're able to set that aside and be clinical in certain cases. But the thing that I always find funny is that it has to be really intentional. So I work in a social robotics lab with a bunch of, you know, students and research staff and people who build social robots. That this is what they do. And they might have a robot on their desk that they're working with, that they're being very clinical with. They know how it works, and, you know, they're not interacting with it like a social agent. And then 5 minutes later, like, we'll have a meeting. Like the other day, I brought this Paro to the meeting, and everyone was like, "Oh, it's so cute!" And they started talking about it in these anthropomorphic terms, even though technically they have the expertise to know what's underneath that skin. And yet, it didn't matter because in that context, they just wanted to like view it as a cute animal-like thing.
Right. We want to connect somehow. That's really interesting. Yeah, we're willing to give up our rationality in order to have another connection in the world. I don't know if it speaks to our loneliness or something that is just inherently human.
I think it's inherently human. I mean, there is research showing that people who are more lonely tend to anthropomorphize more, but everyone does it. I mean, I think it's just part of being social. We're very social creatures.
Why the work with autism? I haven't read your work too much on this. I apologize for that.
Oh, I haven't done any work on
okay,
that.
Okay,
my colleague.
Then I don't feel bad about it. Okay, then I don't feel bad. Thank God. I don't feel bad about the new book. It's not out yet. I can't wait to read it, though. But do you know anything about that work, and why especially are these types of robots good?
Yeah, I know a little bit. So I have colleagues like Brian Scasolati at Yale. His group has done a lot of work on this for the past 10, 15 years. And it's so interesting because what they've discovered is that robots, social robots that engage, you know, with people on an intentionally social and emotional level that mimic cues that we respond to socially, they find that children who have autism, they will treat the robot like a social agent, but they won't. Somehow the robot doesn't come with the same baggage as other people, and so it's a new type of tool that they can use in therapy that actually facilitates communication between a person like a therapist or another child and the kid, the kid can like interact with the robot and then will be more likely to interact with the other people around in that context too. And they actually even did the first longer term study, I think it maybe in the past 2 years, where they put robots in kids' homes and had them interact with the robot for half an hour every day for, I don't know, I think it was a month or 2 months. And then they saw that the kids really improved on social skills generally, like not just with the robot, but in general in their life, in their lives. So it just seems to be, it works better than, you know, a video game or an iPad because it has this physicality and this social connection, and it works better than a human therapist could do for certain things.
Interesting. So a robot is a sort of gateway drug to communicating with other humans. That's fascinating.
That's an interesting way to put it. But yeah, that, I mean, that's what they're observing.
So before we go, I'd love you to think about your, you know, to either go back or go forward and paint a picture that is not one about hyper commercialization. If you can compartmentalize between this utopian or practical part of your brain versus the dystopian practical part of your brain, and paint a picture for us of the nearish and little bit long term view of how things will look in the world for these personal robots.
Yeah, well, I actually do think that there is a path towards, you know, a really cool future with robots, so long as we understand that we do have choices in how we build robots and what we use them for. And I think that sometimes our current conversations get stuck a little bit in technological determinism. Oh, the robots are coming, the robots are going to take the jobs. If we can break out of that mindset and say, oh, we can, you know, build something that actually supports human flourishing here, then I absolutely see a path to a brighter future. So I think what the book really tries to do, even though, you know, I do talk about all of the to be mindful of and the things that we absolutely need to talk about and, you know, policy and other areas, I do think that ultimately we can choose the future. It's not the robots that determine what our future looks like.
You know, you really inspire a lot of people, and I know you really inspire me to think about these things and what could be. And I really appreciate you coming on and talking to me. And I think that we're all looking forward to the book. When does it come out, Kate?
April 20th.
Okay. Well, pretty soon then we'll get to see it.
Thank you so much for having me. This is really great. It was so great to talk to you.
Oh, I hope we can meet in person one day when people are meeting in person.
That would be awesome.
Thanks, Kate.
Thank you.